Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Roshan Balkra, and more importantly, I have the pleasure of inviting back to the podcast Drs. Pankaj Jain and Jeffrey Long. Well, welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Of course, you both have co-edited a brand new publication called Indian and Western Philosophical Concepts in Religion. And now, if I were an undergrad, or perhaps even at present, if I didn't have so much reading to do for our research and for the podcast, I would look at that book and be like, "Wow, I really want to dive in and see what this book is about." So, how did this book come about? Why are you writing a book about comparing Indian and Western philosophical concepts in religion, per se?
So the concept originally is the brainchild of Pankaj, and there's a little bit of a story of how it came together, which I'll share if that's okay. So Pankaj had this concept, and he brought it to the series Explorations in Indic Traditions, which I edit for Lexington Books. And we were all very excited about it, very happy to have it be part of that series. And life is complicated. And Pankaj gathered the articles. He contacted the various authors. They wrote. The process began of compiling it. And then some things happened in his life, which he might want to share. He ended up shifting from the U.S. To India and is at Flame University now. And of course, moving is a very complicated process. So Pankaj and I have been friends for a long time. We met in 2005, I believe, at a Vedanta conference. And we were roommates. We shared a room and then just became friends and have been in collaborating and in touch ever since. So Pankaj very kindly asked me, things have become complicated for me now. Would you be willing to be my co-editor and see this to the final publication? I said, sure, I'll happily do that. Not really thinking through the fact that I was also extremely busy and overcommitted. And as a result, due entirely to my issues, it took a long time to finally get it to the final publication stage. I just, months passed when I didn't have the bandwidth to really look at it. But then I did. And I have to say, I shouldn't say this because I'm a co-editor and I wrote one of the chapters, but I'm talking about this as a team effort. It's really an exceptional volume, and I'm very proud to be connected with it. It was published. It came out last year as part of the Explorations in Indic Religions series. And what it does conceptually, this is at least how I understood what Pankaj had in mind, and this is what I see that the authors of it have done. There's kind of a post-colonial move happening in this volume because Western categories have long been taken to be universal. So we have terms like philosophy, religion, literature, science, culture. And then when Westerners look at different parts of the world, the assumption is, well, these people must also have literature, philosophy, religion, culture, science. And while certainly analogs for those things do exist globally, different societies have different ways of splitting up the pie of reality, so to speak. The boundaries that would differentiate, say, religion and philosophy aren't the same traditionally in India as they have been in the West. And in fact, a lot of what is taken for granted in the West today is not only Western, I would say it's modern. It is related to the culture that has developed since the last 200 to 300 years. People always debate about when the Enlightenment began, and that period that we're talking about is really a very different way of looking at reality, not only from India but from even its own past. Right, you look at medieval Europe, things are very different in terms of how things are conceptualized. The Islamic world has its own ways of conceptualizing things. Indigenous societies across the globe have their own ways of conceptualizing. So we thought, these Indian categories, or Indic categories, South Asian categories, however, whatever term you want to use, these have their own integrity. They have their own insights that they yield if we use them as lenses for looking at reality. Why don't we bring these into conversation with some of these Western concepts, rather than simply taking for granted the supremacy of Western categories? Let's have these categories, let's flip that a little bit. Let's see what it would be like if we utilized concepts drawn from the Indic traditions in a theoretical way, analogously to the way various theories, social theories and so on, are used in the Western conversation. And what would that yield? And so you have the book, as I see, is a series of experiments in doing just that.
Thank you. In a moment, Jeffrey, perhaps you can dive into your paper, but Pankaj, did you want to say anything about the inception or sort of the beginnings or how this all began for you or why this all began?
I think Jeffrey summarized it well. And if we maybe dive down a little bit deeper into the broad category of religion itself, I think then if you can easily agree that, terms such as God or scripture or prophet, right, all these, or even history, all these are really, like Jeffrey said, they're rooted in Western conceptions of religions. I think more specifically Christianity, as many, many scholars have shown, where even salvation, terms such as heaven, hell, all these terms are really coming from Christianity, Bible, and the medieval West, or even classical West. But Indian terms go, I think, really quite different in epistemology and soteriology. All of those categories don't really work in the Indic context, or broadly speaking, non-Western context. So that's what we do. His chapter, Jeffrey's chapter, my chapter, and other contributors are trying to take some Indic terms and see if those terms can be applied globally to different traditions, as definitely specifically at least to the Indian traditions. Indic terms for Indian tradition. That is what is the approach is. Yes.
Yeah, it's a fascinating interplay. There's a class I do, it's called Wisdom Wednesday. We do a close reading of the Bhagavad Gita. It's anybody who's interested, it's sort of satsang, for lack of a better term. And we take a deep dive into some of the philosophy. And for all of my attempts to, and the vast majority of the attendees are not Sanskritists, they're continuing studies students, they may know a bit of Sanskrit. So for all of my attempts at selecting one translation of the Bhagavad Gita, it's impossible. So we have three or four of them we toggle between, because some of them will be brilliant in communicating the sense in English, some of them will be more technical, but every once in a while you'll see a word called religion in the verse, and you're like, religion, what does he mean? And they're translating Dharma as religion.
Mm-hmm. Very bad.
Or Papa is sin, and then there's like, okay, and to what extent is this semantically true, and to what extent is the theological baggage making everyone in the room gag because they're allergic to particular paradigms, this definitely is a thing. So Jeffrey, how about you tell us a little bit about your article?
Sure. So for my chapter, I expanded upon and delved more deeply into a topic that I had done in a paper for Donham at the AAR many years previously, about around 2009 or 10. Whenever Donham was in Montreal, That's when I gave the what was the original version of that paper. The one in the book is actually quite different. It expands upon that original paper, and my focus was on the Jain tradition, and specifically on something which anyone who knows me well eventually hears about this, Anekantavada. So the Jain doctrine of the complexity of existence and the corresponding epistemology of Anekantavada, what's called Nayavada, the doctrine of perspectives, Syatvada, the teaching of how we ought to articulate our ideas in a way that is not absolute or dogmatic, but that is provisional, that suggests that from a certain point of view, such and such is the case. And I, in the spirit of what we were trying to do in the volume, I took that and applied it to a specific Western case of a study of an Indian spiritual figure. And what I looked at was Jeffrey Kripal's Kali's Child on Sri Ramakrishna. And listeners are going to hear that and say, oh no, right? Because there's so much controversy that surrounded that book, and there are very polarized views about that book. I think many people know I'm a devotee of Sri Ramakrishna, so they're probably expecting, oh, you probably trashed the book. Want everyone to know, Jeff Kripal and I get along very well. There's no trashing, but there's disagreement, right? And there are different interpretations and different approaches. And my reading of his book, I'm saying this in the Jain spirit of Syadvada, my reading, it might not be everyone's reading. My reading of the book is that it involves something, and I'm really just using the book as an example of a trend that we see in a lot of scholarly writing, which is this, a trend toward reductionism, right? That if you can show how a particular type of causation was part of the story of how something came to be, other words, psychological elements, which of course is the focus of Kripal's book, economics, power struggles, politics, gender issues. If you can show how one of those elements is a causal factor in the phenomenon you're looking at, you have explained the phenomenon, right? This is at least how I interpret reductionism. So that if we can psychoanalyze Sri Ramakrishna and say, you know, he had certain issues and problems in his childhood and so on, we can then say, now we know why this person talked about the visions that he experienced and had the particular approach to reality that he had and so on. Now, certainly I think there's abundant scope for studies which look at all of these various dimensions of things that we look at, right? I mean, the psychological factors are there, economic factors are there, political factors are there. The intent of my paper was not to say that you should not study, let's say, Sri Ramakrishna in this way. The point of my paper was the following: in the spirit of Anekantavada, and really not just in the spirit of it, but applying it as a kind of theoretical paradigm, what you would have to say is that whatever dimension of the phenomenon you're studying is being revealed by the theoretical lens that you're using is one facet. Right? It's one aspect. It is not all explanatory. Now, knowing Jeff Kripal as I do, I think he would probably actually agree with that. I think he would object to his book being characterized as reductionist. I mean, I'm just saying that the way I read it, it seemed to be doing that, right? And of course, then there could be a debate about parsing particular parts of the book. But again, my larger point is not so much to attack the book. It's to say that, if you do look at something in one particular facet and you don't look at the other facets, this is what Jain philosophy teaches us, you run the risk of falling into ignorance, right? This is called durnaya, right? This is a faulty perspective. It's not that the perspective itself is wrong as such, it's that it's incomplete. And so if we aren't always sort of aware of that, we might offer a very incomplete picture of something. And in the case of this particular book, what happened was that people who were very familiar with Sri Ramakrishna through other lenses, through more traditional lenses, felt deeply hurt and objected. And of course, I think we all know about the controversy that happened. It's been over 20 years ago now that there was this sort of firestorm of controversy around this book. And so if I back up a little bit, what I'm basically making a plea for is methodological pluralism and open-mindedness. There's a tendency, I think sometimes, I think it's better than it used to be, but certainly I think when Pankaj was being educated and when I was being educated, there was a tendency to say that, you know, well, we in the academy, we have the theoretical apparatus, we know what's going on. And what religious believers, right, what people in various communities are doing, that's what we're studying. But they don't really have, you could say, a voice in the interpretation of these phenomena. And I'm saying, why not? And why not bring all of that together? Bring in the sophisticated Western theoretical apparatus and bring it into conversation with the often equally and sometimes more sophisticated voice of these traditions that we're with which we're engaging. So Anekantavada is something that I have what I've tried to do in my article is suggest that this is not only an ancient Jain epistemological model, but it's one that could be fruitfully used by scholars, that it can undergird a methodological pluralism that would be, you know, just as incisive, just as critical as what we do now, but that would also be able to bring in many more perspectives and perhaps make what we do not exactly more accessible, but that there would be a real conversation between, let's say, the perspectives of practitioners and the perspectives of people who are in the academy. And of course, there are those of us who are in both worlds. So that's the vantage point from which I'm saying, well, you can bring these together. And if you think of an analogy with the West, if you think of the way some Catholic theologians, for example, have delved into and drawn upon postmodern thought in their theologies and done some really marvelous work in that regard, there's no reason, I think, that as long as we're sufficiently attentive to we're not again reducing, let's say, the lens of the Indic tradition to whatever is happening in the academic world, but really engaging it as a kind of intellectual resource and partner in the same way that one would draw upon the work of, well, I don't know, French philosophers or something of that sort, right? Something like Anekantavada could be greatly enriching to the whole conversation because you could bring these what would appear to be divergent perspectives together as part of a more complex understanding of reality. And the essence of Anekantavada is that reality is complex. So the more complex of a picture we can draw, probably the more accurate of a picture we can draw. The reductionism is the opposite of what is going to give us illumination when it comes to illumination in the intellectual sense, but perhaps even in a deeper sense as well.
Yeah, there are a number of fascinating and pertinent themes afoot in the particular case that you're looking at, or the data or the argument you're making, but more broadly, the extent to which, you know, when we venture out and study religion, quote unquote, whatever that means, to what extent, and there have been a number of theorists over the last few decades, a couple in particular who would advocate being very clear that it is your job to produce knowledge on this tradition. And there's sort of a bit more perhaps of a delineation between quote unquote subject and object and merely just regurgitating or representing what you see is just, you know, the bare minimum. And really the study of religion entails being clear about your categories and your findings and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then of course, the world is changing and no one is advocating doing poor scholarship, but we are advocating being perhaps good citizens as well as good scholars, perhaps exactly. good people as well as good people, scholars, yeah. And hearing what others have to say, hearing how others have thought about their traditions and having that, you know, the last interview that I recorded was actually with Lori Patton on Who Owns Religion? And she uses Jeffrey Kripal's book as one of her case studies. So it really is a fascinating and timely deliberation. Now, for those listening, Jeffrey's contribution was one of four in the second part of the book called Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain Theories for Religion. So now that we've had this contribution on the theory of religion. Pankaj, do you want to say a little bit about your chapter and that section?
Sure, yeah. So I come from even another world, if I can add, the world of the Indian languages. So my mother tongue, I grew up speaking, thinking, not English. I grew up speaking, thinking, talking, writing, reading Hindi. Hindi is my mother tongue. Now, the Hindi words are really the Indian terms. We never use the word religion at all, right? Because we are using Hindi. And even today, now that I'm back in India, right, for the last couple of years back in India, so we never use the word. Now with globalization, Indian English terms are entering more and more, but the terms that we are using in all Indian languages, by the way, not just Hindi, the word used is dharma for religion. What we end up translating is religion in English. But if you talk to a native Tamil speaker, Telugu speaker, Malayalam speaker, Gujarati speaker, Bengali, Marathi, Hindi, Bhojpuri, Odia, on and on, on and on, all over India, all over Indian languages, the word used is dharma. And I did actually a little bit of field work, kind of an exercise, where I asked all these people who are native speakers of all these different Indian languages, not just Hindi. Everybody is using the word in dharma with very similar interpretations, very different from religion. Yeah. Then when I was doing my research, doing my PhD, I came up with a book co-edited by Jeffrey Kirpal's teacher, Wendy Doniger. And in that book, she edited that volume. And in that volume, there's a chapter by Waitman and Pandey. They did a similar survey with Hindi and how dharma word is used in Hindi. What they found is very interesting. It matches with my observations that dharma has three meanings. Dharma does have the idea of religion or spirituality and rituals and so on. But dharma also connects with physical characteristics of natural elements such as fire and earth and air. And so in Hindi and Indian languages, we say vayu dharma, that is the physical characteristics of wind. Yeah. Right? We can't say air religion. Can we say that in English? That would be such a mess up. Or earth religion. We can't say that. But in Indian languages, we say prithvi dharma. What is dharma of prithvi? To rotate, to create seasons, to create day and night. That is the dharma of prithvi. Prithvi means earth. Dharma of air, vayu dharma, dharma of fire, to burn, right? So all these, so that is the second dimension of the meaning of the word dharma. First is religion, spirituality, rituals. Second is physical characteristics. Third is ethics. It is Arjuna's dharma to fight. It's an ethical duty because of his whatever situation that he was born into or whatever qualities that he had. So dharma has these three intersecting realms of interpretations: physical characteristics, spirituality and rituals, and ethical duties. Those are the three intersecting meanings that we completely lose if we stick with the word religion. That is what I deal in my chapter. I show the entire history, chronological development of this term dharma, how in the Rigveda, dharma comes by replacing rhythm. Rhythm most likely gave us the word rhythm in English, cosmic rhythm. Mm-hmm. Right, so in Purush Sukta 1090.90, we find the first ever reference to the word dharma that replaces the term rhythm. Cosmic rhythm becomes dharma. So dharma is cosmic rhythm in the Rigveda. Mm-hmm. So completely different interpretation. Whole universe of interpretation opens up when we think from Indian languages, Sanskrit, Hindi, and other Indian languages. Then dharma enters the Buddhism and Jainism's realm, and there dharma becomes the moral teachings of the Buddha. In Jainism, dharma simply is non-violence, ahimsa parmo dharma, right? Mm-hmm. And on and on. So all of these interpretive strategies we have to apply and use. And good news is that even English language, like we already all know this, English language has been importing many, many terms from so many different languages, including Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. So in Oxford Dictionary of English, we have these terms dharma, karma, and yoga. These are not official English terms. Mm-hmm. So Vishen, even if you're writing, reading, teaching in English, we should always use the Indic terms such as dharma, karma, and yoga, because those are English terms, not official English terms. That has been my sort of mini campaign over many years. And that's what I tried in my dissertation and then my book, first book, second book. First book is about I intentionally did not name my book Religion and Ecology. I called it Dharma and Ecology. Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Community, not religion. The second book, Dharma and Science, not Religion and Science. Religion and science have been at loggerheads for centuries in the West, right? Athens and Jerusalem have been always in conflict for centuries and centuries. What if they replace religion with dharma, dharma and science? Aren't they in conflict? Not so much, not at all, because many discoveries, scientific discoveries were done by dharmic people, were done by ascetics, sannyasis, or other thinkers. They were doing spiritual things and they were doing scientific discoveries, discovering zero, discovering several mathematical calculations and so on and so forth in India and even I think in China. So that is what I do in my book, in my chapter, and largely my, like I said, first two books and this. But I can go on and on, but we'll wait for your next question, Lars.
Mm. And the first section, the first of the two sections is regarding epistemological encounters.
Mm.
Let's say a word about this. You can be specific with particular contributions. You can just be more general. But this is, I think, is extremely important in laying the foundation for. I think it elucidates the purpose of the book and the reach of the book, and also at the same time helps to uncover the need for it or the types of issues that are at stake. So what is this about epistemological encounters, East and West?
Do you wanna?
Yeah, you wanna try? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I'll say, if I'm recalling correctly, because it's been a while since I actually looked at the book, but I think Al Collins' piece on Sankhya and psychology is part of that section, if I'm remembering correctly. I think, because I recall that being fairly early in the book. Yes, there it is, chapter two. Okay, I'm happy to see that my memory is correct. So, well, all three of those chapters, but Al's is especially vivid in my mind. So he does a very deep dive into the categories of Sankhya and makes a case that you have here a comprehensive model for studying culture, right? That one can look at culture, and he has a very strong background in psychology as well. And he says you can look at culture, you can analyze experience very thoroughly using the categories of the Sankhya Yoga Darshana, the Sankhya Yoga philosophical outlook. And this chapter, I think, is really a great example of what the book is trying to do. And in terms of your question, Raj, about epistemological encounters, right? Epistemology, the theory of knowledge, this is really, this kind of goes to the heart of everything, because what are we trying to do as scholars? We're trying to generate knowledge, right? We're trying to gain, we're trying to acquire and disseminate knowledge. And you could see, sort of just paging through Al's chapter, he's showing how the various categories of Sankhya can operate as lenses for the analysis of experience, and really experience of any kind. Again, that sort of boundary of religious and secular, or religion and science, and so on, is not a category that Sankhya or Yoga utilize, right? They don't. And it's not because, well, they're in one of those paradigms and not the other. No, this is a completely distinct discourse from what Westerners have called religion and what Westerners have called science. It is Sankhya and Yoga. And he utilizes these to look at some practices, some cultural narratives, even the holiday of Holi, right, which is coming in a couple of months, before too long. And so I think what Al has done is really show that there are deep and thoroughgoing epistemologies coming from the Indic context. The two other chapters in the same section, one draws upon Buddhism. There's been a lot of work done on Buddhist epistemology, of course, through the years. That this in particular focuses on the question that our book is centered around. And the other is focused on the concept of Lila, coming from the Vaishnav tradition, Carlson's chapter. And they all three do make sort of this very similar move of how particular categories arising from Indic contexts are perfectly good for, I mean, they're illuminating, right? They can be used in the analysis of phenomena. They have their own epistemic virtues, we could say, things that they are uniquely enabled to yield as concepts. And so our understanding is enriched if we utilize these. And so those chapters are sort of clustered into that section because their focus is this idea of epistemology, right? That what is knowledge? How do we acquire it? And these all three traditions discussed, Samkhya Yoga, Buddhism, the Buddhism chapter is actually first, and then, of course, the Vaishnava tradition. They all have their own insights to contribute to all of this. And so it's an interesting observation on Buddhism, too. Bhutier's article, the first one on Buddhism, it's a fantastic article. It's really a nice entry point into the volume. And as I mentioned, there almost seems to have been, Buddhism almost in some way seems to be an exception when we look at how Western scholarship tends to look at the Indic traditions, Buddhism has been taken very seriously by neuroscientists, by physicists. I mean, all kinds of people are very eager to engage with Buddhism. We don't see that happening so much with the various traditions that fall under the label Hindu, you know, Samkhya, Yoga, etc., Vedanta. The Jain tradition is only now, I think, coming onto the radar of a lot of people in the West. But Buddhism has long been engaged in this way, something closer to an equal level by the Western scholarship, that there's been more of a tendency to take its categories seriously as categories. And of course, one more of those Sanskrit words that Pankaj mentioned that have come into English is nirvana. That's part of that history. Zen, right? Coming, which is actually the Japanese pronunciation of chan, which is the Chinese pronunciation of dhyana, right? Meditation. So all of these actually are part of the Indic conversation. And so I'm really glad we have a strong Buddhist piece there as well to really underscore that.
Who's the book for? Who would most benefit from this book?
I think we have discourses such as theory and methods to study religion at various levels, at undergrad level, grad level. I think that's where the book would be ideally fit. But I think even broadly speaking, even going beyond religion, you know, categories of social science, theory of social sciences will also be, I think, very enriched if we take a look at this book's chapters. And Jeff can add more. Yeah,
I think it's primarily a book for other scholars. I wouldn't want to dissuade anyone from reading it, person, undergrad, anyone, I think, because the articles themselves individually are interesting. If you want to get, if you want to understand Samkhya and Yoga, Al Collins's article is fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
On Buddhism is there. If you want to get a grasp on what is this concept of Dharma, Pankaj's article is there and is excellent for that. So in some sense, the individual pieces also are part of what
separately, yes.
I would see the volume as a whole as a kind of a how-to guide, maybe, not to be too pretentious, but for scholars who want to navigate this territory in a way that's more culturally sensitive and more attentive to the fact that these other lenses exist and deserve as much engagement and validation as the sort of dominant Western categories. And it's not only a matter of trying to sort of level the playing field or, you know, do this kind of post-colonial move. It is that as well. But it's also that we learn them from these categories, right? They illumine things that would not otherwise be so obvious.
Yes.
Is there anything else about the volume that you hope we touch on today?
Pankaj, any thoughts?
I think you covered it well. I think there are two more pieces on Buddhism. One is by a scholar in Thailand, Saroj Hongladero.
Yes.
And then one, John Clemmer. He's right here in India also. So John Clemmer deals with Mahayana Buddhism and social sciences. Mm-hmm. Saroj Hongladero from Thailand deals with anthropology and religious studies through Buddhist lens. Mm-hmm. Then we have one chapter on the concept of Leela, the so-called divine play, is so difficult to translate these terms. Leela is Leela. Leela is not exactly play, but there's a chapter by Carl Olson on the Leela in Vaishnavism, one of the subsects of Hinduism. So that's how that can be developed as a category in social science. And I think other chapters Jeff has already summarized. So some fascinating, innovative chapters, which you don't find anywhere else.
And exactly. And because there is this sort of, you know, popularity of Buddhism, I think, relatively speaking, in the West, we do have strong chapters on Buddhism. So we can say, to promote the book, we say, come for the Buddhism, stay for the Hindu and Jain chapters. Get those as well. And then Pankaj's chapter, he's being modest, but it really kind of underpins the whole volume in a sense. I mean, that's the vision that underlies the various essays. And in talking about the category of dharma, Pankaj ranges across the dharma traditions, right? It's not focused on one specific. It's not focused on Vaishnav or Sankhya or Vedanta or Jain or Buddhist tradition. It really kind of spans this usage across those traditions.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj, for doing this once again. Great to see you.
Thank you. I think this might be my fifth time on your podcast. I was thinking of the books we've done before, and I was wondering if I get a jacket like in Saturday Night Live when the five timers club, you know, the guest host.
Mine is also, I think, third or fourth. Yes.
Yeah. So.
A frequent flyer miles or something like that. I'd have to double check, pull up the because there have been over 300 at this point, but I'm fairly certain that you are the most, you've been on the most times of any other guest on the podcast. I could almost bet money on it. I'll have to create some sort of distinction. You could put it in your email signature. Most appeared on the Indian
Most
Prison
appeared
podcast.
On the New Books Network. Well, I'm grateful, Raj, to be invited, and I'm grateful to Pankaj for inviting me to be part of the project initially as a contributor, but then as co-editor. And and I just, what you know, I'm thinking of all those emails I sent to Pankaj and to the various contributors saying, it's coming, I'm on it. Here it is.
Jeff, we did another great project, the Encyclopedia of Indian Religions for Sprinkler. That also
becomes. Oh, that's right.
Video.
That's right.
So maybe we'll talk about that with Raj on its own.
That's right. That's right. Oh, that's such a massive project. But yes.
Sprinkler Encyclopedia of Hinduism. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is something you're working on now.
No, we already published that. Also.
It's published. It's Arvind Sharma is the editor in chief of the Springer Encyclopedia of Indian Religions, and it's massive. There were two thick volumes on Buddhism and Jainism. I was co-editor of that. We have two thick volumes. The title is. Title is a little controversial. Hinduism and Tribal Religion. I don't know, Pankaj, if you experienced this. I was taken to task by a couple of people online about, you know, you shouldn't try to separate them. They're part of Hinduism. And then you have other people adamant that, why are you lumping them in with Hinduism? And I told everybody, I'm just the editor. I didn't. But there's a lot of really good scholarship in
the definitely.
So I'm very happy with it. Yeah.
Okay, well, we will have to speak about that.
Sure.
We'll have to cover that as well. I mean, it's called Encyclopedia of Indian Religions. How could it not be covered on New Books in Indian Religions?
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much once again. And for those listening, of course, we've been speaking with Drs. Pankaj Jain and Jeffrey Long on a really fascinating new publication, Indian and Western Philosophical Concepts and Religion. Until next time, keep well, keep safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the ways in which, you know, categories may be mutually informative, East and West. Take care.
Thank you, gentlemen. See you.
Thank you. Thank you both.